Good evening then, and welcome to Wednesday's Richie Allen Show, live from Salford City. It is the 27th of March, 2024, Wednesday's show. It's lovely to be with you. It's a glorious afternoon in Salford. Beautiful spring day. I've got two very interesting guests. I know you'll have plenty to say. Get involved via the website, via the app, please.
Uncensored, unfiltered. You're listening to Richie Allen on the world's most popular independent news radio show.
It's the Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Now, Andrew Barr is a Jewish historian and author. He was on the programme previously. Andrew, we enjoyed having him on at the time. He's been in touch with me. He's been researching what he calls the history of Zionist sacrifice of their fellow Jews in the interests of establishing and expanding the Jewish state. And he's going to talk to us about that and more in the second hour. You do not want to miss Andrew Barr. Before that, though, an old friend of the programme will be back, Ryan Christian, The Last American Vagabond. Ryan's a brilliant writer and broadcaster, and I want to get into a number of interesting stories stateside at the moment. So Ryan's on, and I'm looking forward to chatting and catching up with him as well. Yeah, so as I said, if you'd like to reach out to the programme, do so via the app for the programme or via the website for the programme. Yes, that's right. Lots of things for the programme. The app, please download the app. Thousands have. That's not a lie. No exaggeration. Thousands have downloaded it. And you can send a message in a microsecond to me here at the BBG Towers. You just press send, and in a second, microsecond, it is here. So today, Wednesday, March 27th, this coming Sunday, the clocks go forward at 1 a.m. Sunday morning, Easter Sunday. And then you're really into the spring, are you not? Are you looking forward to Easter? You are. Good, so am I, to be honest. I'm looking forward to it. Anyway, so today, the UK media is still leading with, you've guessed it, the accident in Baltimore. Now, it should be fairly straightforward, you know. Container ship hits bridge, people fall off of bridge, and cars fall off of bridge into river below. Mayor and governor vow to rebuild. That is an and finally. I've always said this, you know. And finally, you wouldn't want to be the pilot of this container ship, would you? It should have been an and finally yesterday, but yesterday we received blanket coverage. Nothing but the Baltimore container ship. And leading today, at the top of every hour, you've guessed it, is the same story. I don't know who we grabbed yesterday. I think it might have been Sky. Let's listen to Anita McVeigh, BBC News, this lunchtime, Anita. It's all about Baltimore and that ship and that bridge that is no more. What's really going on there, do you think?
Hello and welcome to you all. I'm Anita McVeigh and you're watching BBC News Now. 3 hours of fast-moving news, interviews and reaction. And we start this hour in the US city of Baltimore. As you've just been hearing in the headlines, we have the news in the last short while that the data recorder of the ship which crashed into a major bridge in the city yesterday has now been recovered.
Woohoo! They have the data recorder. I was properly impressed when I heard this today. I'm not being sarcastic. I didn't know that a ship had the equivalent of an airplane's flight data recorder. I was delighted when I learned this. I wonder what it will tell us.
The crash, of course, caused that bridge to collapse. Six missing construction workers who were on the Francis Scott Key Bridge at the time are now sadly presumed dead, and rescue efforts have turned into a recovery operation. And on your screens, these live pictures from the scene where it's 8 a.m. local time. As well as that recovery operation, the other focus obviously on the investigation into what went wrong.
Great. Thanks, Anita, for the update. Now move on.
Well, let's discuss more now the implications of the bridge collapse.
No, move on.
On trade in the region and beyond. And to do that, we can speak to Guy Platten, who is Secretary General of the International Chamber of Shipping. That's a global trade association for ship owners and operators.
Jesus, International Chamber of Shipping, Guy Platten, blah, 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 boring guy, speculate about trade, and then please move on.
Okay, well, Guy, for the moment, thank you very much. Guy Platten, he is Secretary General of the International Chamber of Shipping. Thank you for your thoughts on that story today. And we're actually going to stay with Baltimore now, and we're going to talk to
no!
a local cafe owner. That's Alex Del Sordo.
A cafe owner called Alex Del Sordo.
The owner of the Anchor Bay East Marina and Hard Yacht Cafe, which is near the bridge.
The Hard Yacht Cafe, did you get it?
And I know, Alex, there in the cafe, you have been helping local people, chatting to lots of local people. I mean, I'm guessing today the mood must still be one of disbelief, really. What have people been saying to you?
What have people been saying?
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. We have, actually, right behind me here, we have Baltimore County Fire Department. There's about nine guys in here right now preparing to go out. And
for what? What are the nine guys from the fire department doing in the coffee shop? And what are they going to go out to do?
And I know that last night we had a crew out till midnight last night working through the wreckage, and they're still in disbelief, but what I'm seeing is that they're starting to really come together with a plan.
Yeah, gripping stuff, Mr. Coffee Shop Owner. Tell me more.
Fire department members, and they said they would normally look out their window and would see this ginormous, beautiful bridge.
But?
And? They can't describe it. It's gone.
It's gone.
It's not there anymore. And they're still in disbelief.
Okay, Alex, thank you very
much. Thanks, Alex. That certainly added to the report.
Much for talking to us today. Alex Del Sordo there.
Now, please move on now and talk about something domestic.
Cafe owner, his cafe overlooking the scene of
Lovely.
That bridge collapse.
Move on, Anita. Come on.
And we've been getting reports in the last short while that five people have died in a bus crash in Germany.
What? A bus crash in Germany?
We understand that a coach veered off the road and overturned on a motorway near Leipzig. That's according to local police. The cause of the accident is still unclear.
Oh my God. Yeah, and it's over to Berlin to Simon Foster to find out a bit more about the coach crash. It's just disaster stories on BBC News, stories that have nothing to do with you or are in any way relevant to you. Thanks, Simon Foster, there in Berlin. To Shanghai next, and a 53-year-old man has died after he fell out of a rickshaw. The man, who was a passenger in the rickshaw, had been out buying a takeaway for his wife. Yes, Chinese people order takeaways too. Standing by in Beijing for us is our Asia correspondent, Ba Difu. And Ba, what more do we know about the man and the whereabouts of the rickshaw driver? Random accident week on the BBC News. What isn't funny? Well, what is funny, and maybe I've gotten it all wrong, a number of people, trucers, some of them, have taken to social media to claim there's something far more serious and sinister going on with the crash of that Dali, named Dali, that big container ship, into the bridge there in Baltimore. So I did reach out to Ryan today and said, listen, we're going to talk about a few things, you know, US politics, obviously, Gaza. We'll have a chat about Gaza, but I'd like your thoughts on Baltimore. He might give us his thoughts on Baltimore. That was genuine, by the way. I didn't swap around those stories. That was it. After we spoken to the guy in the coffee shop there in Baltimore, let's talk about a bus crash that killed five people in Germany. Surely the news readers must be sitting there saying, what the fuck am I doing reading these stories? How relevant are these to my audience? The answer is they're not relevant at all. Here's an important one. An independent United Nations expert, she's an international lawyer, has said that there are reasonable grounds to determine that Israel has committed several acts of genocide in its war in Gaza, sparked by Hamas's October the 7th raid, which apparently killed 1,200 Israelis. I'm not being sarcastic when I say that. This is what they say, 1,200. International lawyer and UN Special Rapporteur for Palestine. Her name is Francesca Albanese. She was speaking in Geneva. It's genocide, she says. She's in no doubt. Have a listen.
After 5 months of monitoring and analysing Israel's onslaught on Gaza, my report finds that there are reasonable grounds to believe that the threshold indicating that Israel is committing the crime of genocide against the Palestinians as a group in Gaza has been met. Specifically, Israel has committed 3 acts of genocide with a requisite intent: killing members of the group, causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group, and deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part. The flagrant and systematic slaughter of Palestinian civilians, the deployment of unlawful weaponry, the utter obliteration of vital civilian infrastructure, including the deliberate targeting of all Gaza's hospitals, and the man-made starvation of the Palestinian people transcend the realm of war crimes and crimes against humanity that had been seen in the occupied Palestinian territory before. The monstrosity unfolding is accompanied by a pervasive anti-Palestinian narrative and dehumanization emanating from the uppermost tiers of Israeli society, including high-ranking officials with command authority, and frequently reflected in soldiers' actions on the ground. This reflects the intent, a dolus specialis, to destroy in whole or in part, which is what distinguishes genocide from other atrocity crimes. In the case of Gaza, there exists a chilling clarity of this purpose: the systematic eradication of an entire people, or at least a significant part thereof. One of the key findings is that Israel's executive and military leadership and soldiers have intentionally distorted, using Bellow principles, subvertive their protection functions in an attempt to legitimize genocidal violence against the Palestinian people. The only reasonable inference that can be drawn from the unveiling of this policy is an Israeli state policy of genocidal violence toward the Palestinian people in Gaza.
Yeah, that's pretty damning, compiled over the last 5 months. So that was Francesca Albanese. Before we get the Israeli response to it, a journalist from Der Spiegel in Germany was offered a question. His question was this. Have a listen.
Yes, good afternoon. I'd like to ask you on the intent of the Israeli government or Israeli militaries to commit genocide. You are saying that there is intent, and you're quoting the president of Israel, the prime minister, the defense minister, and some top militaries. But these are only quotes given in speeches or in other circumstances. I would like to ask you, do you have a written document by the government with a clear intent to commit genocide?
He did really ask that. He asked her, does she have a written document from the Israeli government proving their intent to commit genocide against the Palestinians? He really did ask that. She deals with it. She's incredulous, actually.
Do you think that in Rwanda and in Bosnia-Herzegovina, any government officials wrote a document saying, I want to commit genocide? Have you seen anything like that? I'll answer this for you. No.
Simple as that. In a nutshell, got any documents from Rwanda and Bosnia? And she could have named any number of places. With a smoking gun document, with the government saying we plan to commit genocide? No, is the answer. Governments who are, or who plan to commit genocide, they don't tend to keep hard copies of their plans for people to discover later on and then use those documents to indict them. Ridiculous question from the guy Der Spiegel. Look, we'll get into some of this with Ryan and certainly later on with Andrew on today's Richie Allen Show. Messages, please, to my website, to the app for the programme. I'll be reading them out as I go along. that was Francesca Albanese. I said we'd get the Israeli response. Here's the BBC reporting on the Israeli response to her findings.
Well, Israel has already dismissed Ms. Albanese's findings. Its ambassador to the United Nations in Geneva, Merav Elion Shahar, has described the report as an obscene inversion of reality and accused Ms. Albanese of questioning Israel's right to exist. Well, our correspondent Imogen Fuchs was at that news conference in Geneva and joins us now. So, Imogen, tell us more about Israel's response to this report, as well as other key pieces of reaction to what Ms. Albanese has had to say.
Well, Israel is unsurprisingly furious at this report. It's actually, to be fair, been furious with Israel, Francesca Albanese for quite some time, because she has been very outspoken about human rights in the occupied territories, in Gaza and in the West Bank. But I think the fact that she's come to this conclusion, it's not a court of law at the United Nations, but that she's come to the conclusion that there are reasonable grounds to believe that Israel is committing genocide in Gaza. The word genocide, that's a very big word. It's a very big word to use against Israel, which obviously its foundation as a state was very much as a consequence of the genocide that happened here in Europe in the Second World War against the Jewish people. So they are the Israelis are very angry, very upset. But what I would say is that here in Geneva, which is the humanitarian arm of the United Nations, there are also people who maybe won't use the genocide word there, but there are very many human rights experts and humanitarian agencies who are saying the hunger, the verging on famine in Gaza, the use of very, very massive bombardment, 70% of those killed are women and children, that there are grounds certainly to believe that violations of international law are taking place, although, as I said, not many want to use that very big word, genocide.
Yes, to your messages then, thank you for them. This one from Ian, it's an epic, so I'm just going to synopsize it as best as I can. It's rather arrogant, this one from Ian. He says, Richie, the Baltimore Bridge is not some random accidentally event. It's great grammar, that. It's a vital infrastructure situation. For that boat to hit the very structure that would bring the whole bridge down is either an internal act or that from the outside, says Ian. Wow. But regardless, it wasn't an accident, says Ian, without offering me any proof. He says there are measures in place on all major ports around the world to stop this from ever happening. And then he says, you, meaning me, have to see the bigger picture and who gains and who loses from this event. Spare me from arrogant assholes like Ian, please. Please. You see, one of the most annoying things about doing this job over the years is the complete lack of humility in some of the messages I receive from people. You know, these messages with, it's definitely this and it's definitely that and you've got to see the bigger picture. Ian doesn't have a fucking clue what happened in Baltimore the other night. He's entitled to his opinion, and he might even be right. It might very well be the case that somebody engineered that event, because I don't know that somebody didn't. But it's the lack of humility and the complete lack of ability to converse with somebody that really pisses me off about the Trucer Industrial Complex. You know, learn how to speak and how to write to people. It's not that difficult to be nice and say, maybe you're wrong, Richie. What do you think? Maybe this might have happened or maybe that might have happened. It's just my opinion. It's all you have to say. But these arrogant emails, you know, have you worked in a port? Have you piloted a ship ever? You know, did you even operate a pilot boat, the little boats that go out to guide ships into port? Have you done any of that? Have you any experience? No, you're just opining then. Have the humility, the Christianity, because many of these people claim to be Christians, to say, well, I don't know, but this is what might have happened. It's not that difficult to be nice, you know what I mean? Maybe I really do need a holiday. I've no idea what went on in Baltimore the other day, but, you know, I'm happy for people to theorise about it, but not to be dogmatic and to be telling people to wise up and start to see the bigger picture. Go and fuck off. William says it was a ghost ship, Richie, piloted by the ghost of Roy Orbison. Now, that makes sense to me. If anything makes sense, that is it. Nigel says, Richie, you gave me a heart attack with that big woo-hoo there. I was very excited. We got the data recorder from the ship, didn't we? Wiz asks, didn't anybody on the bridge of the container ship think to drop the anchor when they lost control? See, these are legitimate questions. I have no idea. Rob says it's hardly 9/11, is it, Richie? No, it isn't. No, it is not. Things do happen, you know. Things do happen. Boats do, and this is a very big boat, by the way. They can lose propulsion, engineering. It can go belly up. And if that happens, a massive, massive unit like that will drift. And when it drifts, it can sometimes hit something. And then sometimes when it hits something, it's disastrous. It could very well be that simple. But I concede, I don't know this to be true. But maybe I'm weary after 13, 14 years now in the Truther complex. Maybe I'm weary of the dogmatic who, you know, those who know everything, you know. And every single event that ever transpires, well, it's got to be some hand of some, you know, deep state agent. Well, not always, you know. Not always. Scott says, leave the world behind. It's a recent Netflix apocalypse-type film produced by the Obamas. I remember reading about it, Scott, but I haven't seen it. He says it contained a scene in which a huge tanker cargo ship runs off course and into a beach full of people after a cyber attack. Not saying that Baltimore was a definite deliberate act, but we all know about Hollywood and its pre-programming. Scott is restoring my faith in humanity. Yes. Yes, Scott, maybe. Of course. We've talked about... Listen, I used to sit and listen to Jim Mars on programmes like this for years, regaling me with incidents of predictive programming in television shows, in films, in books. Yes, maybe. I don't know. Who benefits? If somebody deliberately destroyed that bridge, to what end? Give me a qui bono. Give me a payoff for one group or another. And then I'll say, yeah, you know what? But at the moment, I just don't have a clue. Lewis says it's obvious the Zionists don't give a damn about UN resolutions. The reason being that all the leaders of all Western governments are compromised and therefore powerless. I would argue, yes, maybe, but also the Israeli government leaders, they're surely compromised too. We don't imagine that Benjamin Netanyahu is completely free from the clutches of Mossad or other intelligence agencies, do we? Hi to Tim, who says, is it just me going deaf, he says. No, Tim, it's just you going deaf. Cliff says, Richie, did you see John Mellencamp of Jack and Diane fame have a bit of a tantrum when a member of the audience at a gig dared to say to him, stop preaching politics and play some songs? His response was, as he said, to cut the set by 10 songs, play the first line of Jack and Diane and walk off. I guess he sees his role in society differently to the paying public. I didn't see that, no. He wouldn't be the first musician to have a big strop and storm off stage, so he wouldn't. And thanks for all of these messages, by the way, about this bridge. It seems the majority of you are suspicious about the crash, and you've got your suspicions about the bridge coming down. And listen, absolutely, have those suspicions, but don't start shouting the odds to me about it and tell me that I've got to see, wake up and smell the coffee. No evidence that anybody deliberately crashed that ship into a bridge. None. None that I've seen, anyway. We'll see, we'll see, we'll see, we'll see. David says the Baltimore likely accident serves as extremely useful distraction for the deliberate and monumental, he says, bastardry currently going on in the world. Hi to Phil, who says Roy Orbison isn't dead. He is, Phil, but I get you, I get you. And thank you for these messages. 24 minutes past the hour. I'm going to take some music. When I come back, more of your comments, and then Ryan Christian will join us live. Do check out the Last American Vagabond website. It's terrific. And he's got a wonderful daily podcast too. Later on in the programme, Andrew Barr will join me. Andrew set up Jews for Justice. He is a historian and author, and he's a very interesting guy, and he has a very interesting take on what's currently going on in Gaza and maybe why. Music right now from Billy... God, my... Who have I got lined up? Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, my mind is gone. Mind is gone. Yeah, it's Billy Joel. That's who it is. It's Billy Joel. I Need a Holiday. That is Tell Her About It from the album An Innocent Man, which sold about a gazillion copies in 1983, if memory serves. You're with the Richie Allen Show, live from Salford City. Is where it's coming from. Ryan Christian is standing by. Ryan will be with me in a moment. Jan says, hi Jan, whatever happened in Baltimore, supply chains being interrupted again will suit some agendas, I'm sure, says Jan. Yeah, possibly, Jan, no doubt. Sam reckons an anchor wouldn't stop a massive boat like that. It was just a freak accident, nothing else in my opinion, says Sam. Robbie says, did you hear about Bridge 7? It collapsed without even being hit by a boat. Robbie wins the comment of the day. A half dozen Richmond Irish sausages are on the way in the post, Robbie. Very good. Very, very good. Elizabeth says, Richie, the Hague International Court of Justice ruled Israel was committing plausible genocide. Exact legal wording in the ruling when South Africa brought the case. Why is this not getting more legs? I don't know, is the question. It's a good question, and it's a fair and legitimate question, but I don't know the answer to that, Elizabeth. I've no idea. What we do know is that Francesca, the lawyer, Francesca Albanese, she is calling for sanctions, not only on the Israelis, but also sanctions on anybody selling weapons to Israel. That is what she is calling for. It's unlikely she'll get it. Just before we welcome Ryan back, Tommy's in Dallas, and he says, and vulnerable to the bridges and the tunnels too, says Tommy. Thank you, Tommy. Gaz has been in touch to say, Richie, there was a scene in The Simpsons, speaking of predictive programming, this always makes me smile, where Homer drove a boat into a bridge 20 years ago. Probably, he says, I think that was Sideshow Bob, to be honest, performing a one-man HMS Pinafore for Bart Simpson before killing him and eventually crashed into a bridge, as far as I remember. Don reckons the bridge formed an important link for maintaining the food chain. I'm amazed you're so animated by this story, but look, you're animated by it. Let's welcome back to the programme a fantastic journalist and broadcaster. It's great to have him back. He's always great value. There's nobody better briefed than him. Check out the Last American Vagabond website. You've done it before. You'll find him on Twitter as well. Ryan Christian, welcome back to the programme. How are you?
I'm good, brother. And can I just say right out of the gate that I absolutely love that you completely got that right and know that that was Sideshow Bob and not Homer Simpson. I don't know why I love that, but that you just know that.
And you
fantastic.
Know, that means that, thanks, Ryan, that early onset dementia is not happening to me. I couldn't remember Billy Joel's name a moment ago. And I thought, when I was playing Billy Joel, I thought, what's wrong with you? It's Billy Idol. It's Billy Joel. Yes, it was, wasn't it? Sideshow Bob and HMS Pinafore. That's right. Fantastic. Kelsey Grammer, it is always a pleasure to have you on the programme. I've been verbally abusive to my listeners in the last 10 minutes. Because, as far as I understand it, a boat lost propulsion, a massive thing, a few hundred thousand tons, maybe a bit less. It's hit a bridge. It's a very important bridge, obviously, in Baltimore. Terrible thing. But a lot of people, and some of them are pretty smart people, they reckon, don't just write this off, Richie, as a bad accident. What say you?
Well, I can't say that I think I've done as much research as some people that seem hyper focused on this. I'm with you, and I don't immediately sense the, other than the obvious, with everything else that's immediately pressing and going on, why that would take the focus. But obviously we should always, and I've never shied away from this, I don't care if there is literally zero evidence to back it up, we should never shy away from asking the questions. What's the motive behind this? Could this have been an attack from a foreign country? Could this have been our government doing this to justify some kind of action? Could this have been about justifying steps, Great Reset, supply chain. I mean, I don't know why we've ever got to a place where, you know, a logical, discerning human being, we can't ask those questions. Like, that's a strange thing in and of itself.
Yes.
But so that being said, I think that the evidence is interesting. There's oddities, right? I mean, let's just put it like this right out of the gate. I don't think what we have in any way it should be justified. We shouldn't be seeing calls that we know this is that, or we know, like Andrew Tate saying, this is a cyber attack. Well, he's classically coming out trying to tap into certain talking points. People like that are trying to get you to think they know something that you don't. The evidence does not suggest that, or prove that. It's certainly possible that we could be talking about a cyber attack, but why that, like from an Alex Jones perspective, becomes like a China focus and World War III, you know, it just seems hyperbolic. It seems childish, which again, it certainly could be the truth. But for them to say that and to jump into that argument, I feel like this is about trying to get people worked up, the partisan game back and forth, you know, and then to your point about like the Simpson stuff or the Obama movie conversation, you know, you're always going to find parallels. Again, that doesn't mean that maybe that was what it was done for, but until we can prove that, we need to be better than the corporate media and better than these partisan screamers and start being objective about it and leave it there. If we can't prove it, then maybe it was, maybe it wasn't. Wait for more evidence. That's how I feel about it.
Well said. And you're right to point out that people should ask questions about it. The thing that got me a little bit irked earlier was the dogma with which some people approach these things. You know, it must be a false flag because I say it is. Well, look, right. Listen, it might be. I certainly don't know it wasn't. What about the idea? I was desperate to get in touch with you last week and it didn't happen. I should have given you a shout, really. The attack at the Moscow Theatre, which killed, well, scores of people, over 140 people. This idea that Vladimir Putin might suspect a Western hand in that. I mean, he initially laid the blame at the feet of the Ukrainian authorities, and then he rolled back on that, and I believe the Russian president then seemed to go along with the idea that it was Islamic State. But there are those who watch Russia carefully, as you do, and this is why I'm fascinated to get your theory on this, who say, well, if Putin suspected, if the Russian president suspected that there was any Western involvement in the attack on the theatre in Moscow, that he wouldn't be above, or it wouldn't be beneath him to try and do something in retaliation, and along comes a mysterious incident where a great big ship crashes into a bridge. You know, that might be 2 and 2 equals 12, and shoot me down if you want, but it's interesting. Tell us about what your thoughts on that attack in that theatre in Moscow. That was terrible and completely unexpected, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, there's a lot. There's so many interesting things about this whole thing. But to your point first, you know, again, it's certainly one of the possibilities. I don't know why anybody would just out of turn, just completely disregard that as a possibility. Of course, that could be. But you could make logical points about, you know, then why didn't something, or maybe did and we didn't tie it together, but why didn't something happening after Nord Stream pipeline or, you know, other advances, situations like that? I tend to see Putin as being far more calculating and measured than pretty much any politician out there today, especially in the West. That doesn't mean good guy. It just means that he's very politically, very smart about the way that he conducts himself, especially in the counterbalance of the belligerence of the U.S. Western foreign policy. And so I think that, you know, it would make sense that you know, let's put it this way. When he came out and said about Ukraine being involved, the obvious reality that I pointed out is that's a very logical concept in that with all the information they put out right in the days following, I don't see how you walk that back, quite frankly. And the point being that if Ukraine's involved at all, it's even if they acted alone, there's still complicity. There's still involvement of both Israel and the United States with what they've built and what they've done in Ukraine. But more than that, I actually believe there's evidence suggesting that they were involved in some way in action, in like more so a CIA Ukraine angle, but Israel as well. But I would say, to throw another interesting point in, it would actually make more sense to me that out of all the politicians and the way that they've conducted themselves, that Putin would make a logical conclusion that it's more damaging to the world system to make an allegation like that if he can't prove it than to go back with the ISIS. Like, I don't think Putin or any of these governments are always acting in the interest of the truth or people. I think they act in the interest of their own agendas, all of them. And that may be that, well, we don't want this to blow up right now, so we're going to go back with the ISIS narrative. Like, that would actually line up with something that I can see them doing. But that's not to say we know, right? So all that's ultimately going back to the fact that we had a terrorist attack or whatever you want to call it. And all of the evidence completely points in the direction of Ukraine. It points in the direction of, or honestly, a more of a Mossad overlap. But I think what's interesting is the way it was covered, the way that the media comes out essentially just going, oh, ISIS said, So now we just take ISIS's word for it. Like, I'm actually going to do probably a show either today or tomorrow going more into that in the historical conversation about how ISIS claims things and how I always do this, showing you their own words, however many years ago, highlighting the fact that, no, we shouldn't just take what they say at false value. We know sometimes they say things when they don't actually behind or aren't actually behind it. They know that. And yet today they have a clear interest in going, they said it, so we know that's them. U.S. comes out and says, intelligence says, and there's nothing else they show you. So it's all just a narrative that ISIS was behind it, which honestly far more makes me think that's not the case. And then we get into the ISIS-K overlap, which they clearly say is the one that was behind it. And I honestly believe, and the more I look into this, that ISIS-K in and of itself, assuming it was even ever really a true thing that existed, and I don't mean that there weren't people involved, but there was ever a real organic concept other than a proxy concept put together, that I don't think today it even truly is there. I think this is a name that is thrown out. And I mean, India accuses Pakistan of being behind it. Pakistan accuses India of being behind it. They all aim at each other, all their enemies. And ISIS-K becomes this catch-all, even if it is real, just to go, ISIS-K did it, and everyone backs it. And we see this happen over and over. San Bernardino was one of those. And they really said that those people are our supporters. And everyone said ISIS-K was behind it, even though it was more likely some kind of U.S. agency behind it. But in any case, it's an interesting dynamic. And then with all the other stuff, the boat involvement, I think that my big thing is I can't see. Right when this started happening, Israel went gung-ho in Rafah. And I mean, like, bombing more in Rafah than I've ever seen before. Now, it could just be they took advantage of it. But that's the one that stands out more than anything to me. But any of those are possible.
Ryan, just before we come to Israel, speaking of that dynamic where you have Western media and Western politicians just repeating and rinsing the line, well, ISIS took responsibility for it. We've had a very interesting story this week here in the UK. I know you've been following it, where the British government, the Deputy Prime Minister, Oliver Dowden, basically said the Chinese hacked some of our senior politicians and also hacked the Electoral Commission and hacked into 40,000 voters' records because we said so. So we've got that going on here as well. The Chinese came out and said, one of their spokesmen spoke to LBC Radio in London. I thought he spoke pretty well. He said, look, it really doesn't matter to us who's in government there. I thought that was a stark admission. I mean, you and I would agree, it doesn't matter. Certain agendas proceed without any faltering steps, regardless of which governments are in. But I wonder why now? Why now this talk about we've got to name China as our enemy? This is the sort of language they're using. They're saying we've got to come out now and say, look, China is the world's most serious economic threat to our security and our way of life. What's really going on there, do you think?
Well, they said it right there. Like, why is it that their economic success is somehow at the detriment of you, right? It's really what it is. It's at the detriment of their corporate interests.
And it's their fault too. Sorry, Ryan, it's their bloody fault, because over the decades they allowed Chinese businesses undercut domestic businesses, didn't they? And businessmen and businesswomen. And the chickens have come home to roost now, right?
Right. Well, I mean, what you're highlighting there is the fact that, and this is both the same for US and UK politics, that they take immediate short-sighted action to grossly benefit themselves at your expense. That's politics for you. And so the point is that now they go forward and they recognize that those short-sighted actions have allowed another country to take an advantage, and now they start pointing at their byproduct as the reason they need to take action against China. And it's just this constant circling of their own. I mean, it doesn't mean that everything all the time is the responsibility of the UK and the United States, but we have to pay attention to how it's obvious that the biggest cataclysmic kind of like conflict driving entities in the world right now are all the people screaming about the rules-based international order, more so the ones leading it. And then you got the tangential groups that kind of just go along to get along in some ways. But I think it's obvious that what they're pointing at is just the idea that China and the idea that it's like preeminence. I mean, I look at this more so from a U.S. perspective, because I think that's really driving that narrative from my perspective. But, there's actually a good conversation to have about whether even Israel or UK or whoever's leading some of these charges. But from my perspective, from a U.S. citizen, is that it's clear that they're desperate from an establishment mindset that has nothing to do with interest of the Americans. In fact, in a lot of ways, you'll probably get better things or cheaper products, whatever. Not to say that that's better for geostrategic policy. but that they literally recognize that it's just simply damaging for their agendas and their control over certain, you know, usually black market illicit industries around the world, or, you know, what they're stealing from resources in Africa that China's trying to offer more amicable deals for, you know. And it's not, again, it's not good guy, bad guy. I will always maintain the fact that I think any of these governments, and as evidenced by the overwhelming surveillance state that China's built around their people, any of these governments, with given the amount of power the U.S. has, would be the same thing, in my opinion. And maybe I'm a pessimist. I hope I'm wrong. But I think that's the point. And so we can see they're basically just vying over who's going to exploit you. You know, I hate to say it like that, but I think that's the truth. You know, and that's why, when it comes back to that larger point, you know, going back to Russia for a second, we should never shy away from asking if this was all like a ploy. Like, you know, one of the things I talked about in my show, and I honestly don't see the evidence for this just yet. Maybe it's not there. But we should ask, is it possible that Russia executed this for the effort to blame Ukraine? Like, that's certainly possible, right? And that could be a false flag. You know, I even pointed out the idea of, like, the some of the first people that they seem to arrest. There's inconsistencies there. And I don't know whether, I mean, that tends to happen. People get arrested that weren't necessarily the people they look for, and that gets kind of blended on social media. But I saw some examples of people that don't seem to line up with what I saw at the end. And so I note that down. It could be a discrepancy. It could be, you know, maybe I made a mistake. But at the moment, I don't see that evidence, but it's just certainly possible. And I think all of these governments are capable of that, you know. And so the whole China dynamic is really just, I think, pinning your hatred and your concern on the person they think is most damaging to their personal financial benefit and their benefit of the larger agenda, you know. And I think that comes down to dehumanization. That's always, look at the Palestinians. They've been doing this to all of them, but I see the same thing from U.S. as well. They put out many documents about China being the next big threat. And, you know, and I think, honestly, if you want to put a 1-point pin on it, it's never about one thing. It comes down to rare earth minerals and the desperate need for the next step in the great reset, nanotechnology, electronics. I mean, they are desperately in need of these things. And China's like a massive hotbed. I mean, I think they currently still get most of them from China.
And the Chinese are heavily involved and embedded on the continent of Africa, aren't they, Ryan? And listen, mm-hmm. This is one of the reasons why we love thelastamericanvagabond.com. You are one of the very few that will make these points. Whatever you think your own intelligence agencies are capable of, be damn sure that the Chinese and the Russians are capable of doing the exact Absolutely. Same things. And that's a message that you don't get in a lot of independent media. Ryan Christian is our guest. Let's talk about Francesca Albanese. Unsurprisingly, I suppose, 5 months looking into what's been going on. UN Special Rapporteur. She's a very well-known international lawyer. She's hated by Tel Aviv, there's no doubt about that. She said, didn't she, in Geneva, look, we're pretty sure all the evidence is there. 3 counts of genocide. And she's calling for sanctions, of course, to be placed against the Israelis, as the sanctions, of course, were levied on Russia after the invasion of Ukraine. What's good for the goose, maybe. And she's also called for anybody selling weapons. This is interesting, of course, because the UK, along with the US, sends a lot of materials to Israel. She's calling for countries who would do business with Israel to be sanctioned too. I hate to be a pessimist. I've been around the block a few times, just like yourself. Great words, but are we likely to see any action?
Yeah, that's the kind of main issue with all of this. I mean, we just saw what is regarded as a legally binding UN Security Council resolution be completely disregarded by Israel, which we all knew would happen, right? I mean, and even the U.S. came out and watered it down. I think it was Matt Miller that acted like it was non-binding. And then you got the U.S. Security Council team, I think Mozambique in particular, came out and said, he's wrong. I've done this my whole life, and this is, you know, and it's just so grotesque the way that they keep watering this down and acting like it doesn't matter, you know. And so to this next point, I mean, I can almost guarantee you that they just won't care. But this is where it comes down to these major points, whether we're talking about the UN as a whole or even just the body itself and whether it should even exist. But since it's currently in place, the point is, as a whole, you can't allow specifically very wildly one-sided biased political entities, or whether they are or not, but that's what we're dealing with, to have the veto power over everybody else involved. And that's what keeps happening. And it's over and over and over. Everybody else agrees, and one veto. I mean, the last one only passed because the U.S. abstained, and even the U.K. voted for it. You know, and that, to your point, what's even more gross about it is both them are continuing to sell weapons to a group that they just voted to stop, and they disregarded the legally binding resolution. And they're still, by the way, illegally both by international law and at least by U.S. law, continuing to send them weapons. It's just crazy. And so all of this, I think what's important to see is that these people at the highest levels of power, I guarantee you at some level, they're a bit concerned by this. They recognize that should this truly turn the wrong way, they could end up in prison. Like, that's legitimate at this point. And I don't think it's going to happen. I hope it does. But I think they know it somewhere in their mind that's actually possible because of how belligerent Israel's been and how it woke up half the world to something they've never even known existed, you know? And so her resolution, I think, is powerful. It's important. Now, I've got a lot of respect for Francesca Albanese. I have a very clear skepticism and, you know, always constant level of doubt for anybody involved in the UN or any position of authority, quite frankly. But I just see, I've seen her over the years consistently stand by in points of integrity. You know, and especially right now, anybody that's standing against the insurmountable, at least it was before this started, complete overwhelming propaganda of the U.S. Zionist government and the control over governments and so on, and stand against that, knowing that she might even get, you know, lose her job, whatever else, that takes courage, you know. And so she stood that line right in the beginning, and she always this day. And now, to your point, she put out this, you know, basically the breaking down the three different points, and it's scathing, you know, citing all the different deaths, all the information, the intent and everything. And so the point is, we have the UN Security Council resolution. We've got, you know, pretty much realistically every major human rights group in the world, every major UN organization, most every government in the world has now acknowledged what's actually happening. And yet it still is dragged forward because the US is too cowardly to do something about it. You know, at least the rest of them have voted for the ceasefire, you know? So that's really what it comes down to. And so I praise her for doing that. And I think that I just hope that she keeps the same kind of objective line on other things that we get into down the line, you know, who
fair
knows?
Enough.
But
yeah,
this is important.
If I can interject there, I had it out a few weeks back with Kevin Barrett over how Israelis feel about this. We don't often hear from Israelis. And of course, I mean, men and women who go about their 9-to-5s and then come home and feed the kids. And Kevin wanted me to believe that as many as 89 in 100 Israelis are thrilled about what's happening and delighted about it. Now, I don't want to believe that, and I'm not here to curry favour with anybody. And previously, I would have argued with him about who's really responsible here. Because if you want to look at each country, if you want to take countries, Ryan, in isolation, and if you want to treat a country like a corporation, and in law you accept that a country is a single person, right? So the government of Israel will say that's a thing. Well, it's obviously psychotic in what it does, but in reality it's a country with several million people there. And I don't really know if, and I think maybe, I hope it is the case that the Israelis themselves just feel completely helpless to do anything about this. Am I being naive when I say that? You do see some pockets of it on Twitter. People living in Tel Aviv, Israelis who are saying they can't believe it. You know, people who questioned what happened on October 7th, why it happened so relatively easily, where was the security and all of that. But I just don't want to believe that nearly everybody in Israel agrees with what is happening. You covered this story far more than I do, and you're all over it, you and your colleagues, Whitney and others. What do we know about how Israelis feel about what's happening?
Well, first and foremost, I always direct people to the very large body of work from Abby Martin over the last decade, where she's, you know, in and out of the West Bank and areas in Israel and talking to people and getting their opinions and, you know, on the record, you know. And so sadly, I think the reality of this, and it's not as simple as saying it's all or nothing or that, you know, they're either with or against. It's just never that simple, you know. But the reality, I think, is very clear. First and foremost, that I don't know if I can say 8 out of 9 or 8 out of 10, but I think that a clear majority of Israelis definitely agree that this should be happening in Gaza. Now, there's a whole level to that. Some of them don't necessarily want people to be killed indiscriminately. Some of them definitely think all Palestinians should die. Some of them just want Gaza back for Israel and want the people to be removed and don't want anybody hurt. Like, there's all sorts of levels to it. But then, of course, and I think this is important, and this is what I battle with even recently with somebody who I agree with most of what they're putting out, that it's obvious to me, provable, that you have large groups or of Orthodox Jewish communities, of Israelis, of Jews in general, or people that live in Israel that aren't Jews, that actively, openly disagree with, first and foremost, Gaza and what they're doing there, the current October 7th, past that post October 7th incursion, or the idea that Israel represents Jews in the world, or that Zionism is Judaism. You know, I point out lots of these groups that actively protest this in Israel, in London, in the United States, and they're huge groups. Now, that doesn't mean even remotely a majority of the population of Israel, but it's important because all that means is we can't just say all Jews or all Israelis or all anything. Like, at what point do we stop realizing broad stroking groups of people is ignorant? You know, the corporate media does it every 30 seconds today, you know? And so I think that's the first point to realize. And so, yes, it's a sad reality, but the question to ask is, for that, let's just say majority, why? Why do they think that? Now, you could argue some of them just are bad people. That's always the case. The same reason you could say there's bad people in the United States, they just hate people because of their skin color. That always exists wherever you are in the world. There's some of that. But I think the bigger portion of this is about the way that they were raised, the way that they were taught. And I mean, there is an overwhelming body of evidence from IDF members, from school teachers in Israel, people that spoken out over the years and said, this is why the population feels this way. They're engineered to think that no matter what they're doing, they're always defending themselves. And this isn't me. This is direct statements from people in their society. They're taught that everything they do is justified because God said it was justified, like things like that. And yes, so a lot of them, whether it's because they choose to believe it or because they don't know any better, go forward thinking that this is what's supposed to happen. And now another point to add, and I just went over this last night. Haaretz wrote an amazing article a while back, 2001 or 2000, post 2000. And it was talking about the 1956, 57, I think it was called Operation Kurdish. Sinai campaign, I think, is the other name for it. And this was a massacre. Right. It was and the evidence on the table, which even Haaretz put forward, was exactly that they raped, they pillaged, they shot people, they lined them up because they just didn't want them to exist. A person spoke on the record with a news outlet that said he will kill as many Arabs as possible every day. He will torture them every way he can. Like, these are public statements. Now, that's not that even then. And this is the important part. Not everybody involved, because this is what we have to understand. The Zionist agenda was what was doing that. Early on in this conversation, I reference often Avi Shalom. He's a British Israeli historian, very highly respected, who talks about how there's Mossad agents that were bombing Jewish people in Iraq to drive them into Israel, right? There's all this public information. The CIA talks about how they were willing to sacrifice Arab Jews in other countries because they wanted to get the state of Israel. The point being that at that time, there were Israelis and Jews who were speaking to the Israeli government and saying, a Knesset member at the time actually spoke up and made this claim. And that they said, you're killing innocent people and we're not okay with that. We're embarrassed by this. We don't represent this. Now, my point is, I think that's still part of this conversation today. But over the last 75 years, the Zionist agenda has slowly and systematically changed the opinions and through schooling and propaganda of all the people that grew up and lived there. You know, I think that's what we're really talking about. And so I point out, it's the same way that the U.S. government convinces children in this country that murdering people for war is somehow justified. You know, and that's just how we grew up, and we think that we're fighting for freedom. It's really the same concept. So it's important that we just don't broad stroke any of these. So I would disagree with 8 out of 10, but I definitely sadly agree that it's a majority. But I just don't think it's as simple as saying they all just hate people because, you know, they're racist. But yeah, it's sadly part of it.
What's interesting is a British Jewish historian, Andrew Barr, is coming on with me next hour. And I think he's listening to some of this, so it'll be interesting to get his take on it. Andrew will be with me in hour two. You're listening to Ryan Christian, thelastamericanvagabond.com. Ryan, what's very interesting last 24 hours? So former President Donald Trump, his technology company was effectively floated, or it debuted on the stock market, didn't it? And it's brought in a valuation of around about $4 billion. I think Trump makes it to the Fortune 500 list for the first time. He's got 7 million users now using Truth Social. He's got legal issues as well, of course. He's got legal bills. And yet it's looking very much like, despite all of this, he's not a shoo-in, maybe, but he's certainly favourite to be re-elected as president this coming November. Do you sometimes have to pinch yourself? Because this is the greatest soap opera of all time, isn't it? This Donald Trump story.
Yeah, or just U.S. politics.
Or U.S. politics, yeah.
I agree. I think that it's, I mean, I've said this already. I said this a while ago, but I think Donald Trump's going to win. Not because I want that, but I think that's what the plan is. But I think that it's interesting to see how this has gone. And I think that he's already playing the field like he did before. Like, I mean, look, he's savvy when it comes to how he manipulates people in politics. I mean, he is a politician, despite what his followers would say. And I think he's good at it when it comes to that. You know, and at the same time, I think I like him as a politician, because in other cases, he's very blunt about it. You know, we're there to take the oil. It's like, well, good. At least he's being honest about how they're stealing oil, you know. But I think what he just did is important in regard to Israel. And this is what I see him doing. Remember in the beginning of the last election, he was all about, you know, lock her up, Federal Reserve, 9/11, yes. JFK, all these the things wall. That he just dropped.
Yeah.
You know, and none of that happened, right? And it was all because he knew he was tapping into the middle ground, the people that were looking for a third party, people that wanted something different. And so they got together, I think, and were like, well, how do we tap into that? You know, and so now what's he doing? He came out just recently after being so pro-Israel's entire career. He came out and said that Israel's kind of responsible for what's happening. And that but not hard, not saying Israel's committing genocide, but he did it like he always does, very tactfully, right down the middle. So he lets both sides assume what they want based on what he's saying. No, this is what he meant. You know, and so the point is, he basically is starting that field, I think, where he's going to start tapping into what he thinks the real body, not the two-party illusion, but the huge voting block, which is that most people that don't partake actually think. And that's what I said when he first got elected. He awakened the dumb sleeping giant of U.S. politics, and all these people that were never politically activated suddenly thought they knew everything because Trump said, and, you know, and which is good. I mean, I'm glad to see people activated politically, not necessarily voting, because you know my opinion of voting, but being politically activated is good. But I kind of see where that's going already.
It's hilarious. We need to finish every program we do with Won't Get Fooled Again by The Who. Just to remind these people, you know, that whatever he promises, whatever he says he's going to do, he'll go back to being the same hawkish, you know, pro-Israeli Trump that he was when he served his 4 years. Ryan, it's been brilliant having you back on, pal. Thanks for your time today. And thank you for being you. Do you know, today, I invited you on today. And only because I was inviting you on did I realise that your clocks had gone forward, because I left you down a few years ago. I agreed a time with you and I forgot the clocks had changed. And that's how the brain works sometimes. It's incredible. And because it was you today, I thought, I wonder, have the clocks changed in the States? And they have changed. So thank God for you, pal. Really appreciate you. And all the crew at thelastamericanvagabond.com. Busy year. You've got packed days, but you always make time for us. So we appreciate it. Thanks as always. I can't wait for next time. Cheers, Ryan.
Thanks, brother. My pleasure.
Bye for now. Ryan Christian live on the Richie Allen Show. Wednesday's program, the 27th of March, 2024. Now, there was something I said I would do. And it's important. Ah, yes, 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 yes. I had a message last week, didn't I? I had a message last week, and it was from Roy. That's right, it was from Roy, from Ryan. Ryan, it was from. And he said to me, Richie, will you do me a favour? He said, will you give a shout out to my missus? Because it's her birthday on Wednesday. And I said, of course, I'd be absolutely delighted. She listened, so does Ryan. It's Gemma Gill. So Gemma Gill, happy birthday today. And that comes from your fella Ryan, who sent me a message over the weekend. And just by the grace of God, I saw the message today. So happy birthday, Gemma Gill. Have a great day. I hope you're having a fantastic afternoon and that you're being well looked after. Music from Altered Images when I come back. More of your comments. And yes, we'll be speaking with Andrew Barr. I can't wait to chat with him again. This is for Gemma. Happy birthday, Gemma.
Ask not what the BBG can do for you, but what you can do for the BBG. Support The Richie Allen Show now at richieallen.co.uk.
Yes, and thank you for your messages. I greatly appreciate them. There was one, I was reading it a moment ago and I've just lost it. Let me read it. It's from Brendan. And Brendan says, Richie, I work in New Haven Marina as health and safety officer. I used to take men out to the navigation buoys or buoys in the English Channel. They worked for Trinity House. I have a little bit of knowledge about container boats, but he says, number one, I don't think the anchor would have stopped the container ship. Secondly, he says, accidents happen. If it lost power, you cannot steer the boat. In my opinion, just an accident for now, says Brendan, open to evidence forthcoming, he says. Thank you. And that's the way you kind of have to look at it. Ryan Christian was absolutely spot on when he said, ask questions, disbelieve, be suspicious, 100%. But I don't know, I've lost a little bit of patience over the years. It is a failing of mine. I'm the first to admit it is a failing. I have lost a little bit of patience. Ironically, funnily enough, it was something David Icke said to me years ago. He said, in the end, Richie, It is the dogmatic types, you know, the definite types who know it all. They'll eventually drive you mad. It was David said that to me. And it's not driving me mad, but it's a bit, I suppose it's a bit sad, really. You hope over the years that, you know, I learn a lot from my guests. I've learned a lot from my listeners. You hope that it's kind of reciprocated. We just don't know. You know, we don't know. You might say, and you have every right to say, looked a bit weird that to me, or there might be something going on there. But to be telling people to wake up and wise up and just stop doing that. No good can come of it. We had these conversations during the COVID thing. You remember me lecturing people, and I shouldn't have done it maybe, but, you know, trying to educate people about how to speak to people. You're not going to bring anybody on board by dogmatically telling them the way it is, man. You're just not going to win friends and influence people. I found it a wonderful thing over the years. It was an Irishman who said to me in Spain years ago, when I was gobbing off on the radio in Marbella, an Irishman said to me, and, you know, I do have thick skin. I do. I can take it on the chin. An Irishman said to me, you know, Richie, you might want to consider every now and then saying, you know, in my opinion. And for a moment, it kind of briefly kind of smarted. And then I thought, he's right, you know. He's right. You bring more people on board when you say, well, look, I don't know, but I've been hearing that, you know, these jabs are causing a lot of trouble for people. Rather than telling people the jabs are poison, they're deadly. You know, a lot of people, their minds just shut down. I've seen it. Their minds shut down. They're not interested. It's like, all right, yeah, fair enough. And they've just drifted off and left you there, you know. Anyway, we're going to give Andrew a call now. I've no doubt you'll have plenty to say. So do reach out to me during the programme. It is, of course, richieallen.co.uk. That is where you will find Comment Live, but you can download the app and send an instant message to me that way as well. Download the app, you know. Oh, look. Put the fader down, Richie. It's one of those bloody weeks, this, I think. Hey, listen, before we welcome Andrew back, let me remind you who Andrew is. He is an author. He is a historian. He's Jewish, is Andrew. And I was first introduced to him by the lovely Dr. Jane Dunigan. I was introduced to him because I think Jane had been sharing the madness with Andrew. You know, the idea that people would avoid speaking with people because maybe those people had been you know associated with guests and what have you. To put it very simply, this program, as you well know, has been censored through self-censorship. People have decided over the years, maybe I won't come on because well Richie Allen, he spoke to a Holocaust denier one time, didn't he, and I can't be associated with that. So this is how I was introduced to Andrew. As I said, he is an author, he is a historian, he's got a Substack, which is really interesting, and I will put all the details on the podcast notes, a link to the podcast and a link to where you can find Andrew on Twitter. It's very simple. He is Andrew Barr 2020 on Twitter. Do give him a shout there. So we've been communicating on via email over the last few days, and he said to me, did Andrew, that he has recently been researching the history of Zionist sacrifice, he says, of their fellow Jews in the interests of establishing and expanding the Jewish state. There's much to talk about, not just about that, but other issues as well. Let's welcome back Andrew Barr to our programme, the founder of Jews for Justice. Andrew, it's lovely to have you back on. How are you?
Thank you very much, Richie. I'm very well, thank you. And I must say, I was fascinated by Ryan Christian's grasp of geopolitics.
Fascinated, or were you flustered or frustrated? I mean, feel free.
No. I mean, in an ideal world, the three of us would all have a conversation, because there's some things I would very much like to discuss with him about his view of Zionism and Israel, some of which I agree, some of which I disagree with. But his grasp of international geopolitics is far beyond me. I must say. That's not my expertise, and it's clearly his.
It's pretty good, but I love the idea of putting people together so we can have these discussions, and he's an absolutely top guy, so I will make that happen, where we could have that conversation. It's a funny word. It's thrown around all the time, particularly in the independent media, Zionist or Zio. My understanding of it is, and I'm a history graduate. I don't know if you know that. I'm not a historian, not like you. But my understanding of Zionism, a permanent home for the Jewish people. It's the ideology that the Jewish people have to have a permanent home, place, homestead. And that's the most basic definition I understand when I think of Zionism. Do you think it has become a dirty word, or a word that is thrown around too easily by people who don't understand it, maybe?
Well, I think the problem is that none of us really understands what it means now. So up until the State of Israel was founded in 1948, it was pretty clear what Zionism meant, that it was a campaign to re-establish some kind of Jewish national home or state. That was never made clear until it was established, whether it was a homeland or state, in the Holy Land. But since Israel has been refounded, the meaning of Zionism has had to change. And we're in what I would describe as a post-Zionist world. I mean, I always, if people ask me if I'm a Zionist, I tend to cop out and say, I'm a post-Zionist. But that's, I feel, is the correct answer, that I can't see the point in arguing whether Israel ought to exist. The issue is, where should we go from here? And everyone has a different perspective now on what Zionism means. I mean, originally, Zionism was a secular socialist political movement. There was a religious wing, but it wasn't very prominent. Now, you have a very substantial proportion of religious Zionists who have a completely different perspective from the political Zionism, and they have a significant part to play in the current Israeli government, because the left and the center originally, until the war started, left and the center wouldn't make a deal with Netanyahu. He had to go make a deal with the outer religious groups and the religious right. So there is now quite a significant religious input into what the Israeli government does. So Zionism now, for many people, takes on a more religious aspect. Essentially, I think it means today, Zionism is support for the existence of a Jewish state in the Holy Land. But then you have the whole question, what do you mean by Jewish? Do you mean for Jewish people? Do you mean that has Jewish religious principles? Do you mean that's established according to Jewish moral and ethical principles, which aren't necessarily religious? And then a lot of people, I think Zionism means supporting essentially what the Israeli government does in its position. So when you look at pieces of market research, you get completely different results for when people ask the question, do you support the existence of the State of Israel? And most Jews certainly would say yes. And then they ask the question, are you a Zionist? And many, many fewer would say yes. So Jews don't know what Zionism means. So I don't think anyone can be blamed for having their own view as to its meaning.
Really interesting this. Your point about it not being relevant anymore, you didn't say that exactly, I don't want to misrepresent what you said, but that this whole argument about whether Israel has a right to exist or not is kind of moot. I'm going to agree with that. I'm going to agree with that. I never thought I'd say this
on
the radio.
You can disagree if you want.
No, I am going to agree with it. Look, I would have spent most of my life, even up until recently, saying that there's no legal, nor is there any moral case for Israel's right to exist. That's what I would have believed. But now I absolutely agree that it doesn't matter anymore. It does exist, like it or lump it, it does.
Yeah.
And it's not going to cease existing, certainly not in my lifetime. And I have to say that. So you know how this show works. We're mates. We're going to have a chat now for the next best part of 40 minutes. So I'll throw a few different questions about different things. What do you reckon to the claim by Francesca Albanese, the lawyer, that genocide has and is occurring in Gaza, and then the Israeli government response, which is she's an anti-Semite, she has a history of hating Israel and saying that Israel shouldn't exist. The first point Is it genocide, in your opinion, what's happening in Gaza?
Well, I think I'm going to bat that one back to you by saying that I know you've corrected yourself and said I'm an historian, not a lawyer. Had I been a lawyer, I would have had to have an opinion as to whether it was genocide or not. As an historian, I think all I can do is offer an historical perspective on this question. And I thought it was particularly interesting you played someone talking about the Israeli response to what she'd said, saying, well, look, the reason why the Israelis are so upset is because Israel was founded because of genocide.
Yeah.
And that is a very common misconception. Israel was not founded because of the Holocaust, but it's in the interest of Israeli propagandists and Israeli state to push forward the idea that Israel was founded because of a Holocaust. This was a reconception of Israel dating from really the Adolf Eichmann trial in 1961. Until then, nobody really talks about the Holocaust. Partly, I think, because survivors were too traumatized. Some survivors felt in some way there was shame upon them because they'd survived, whereas others hadn't. And you just don't find people talking about the Holocaust in politics in the 1950s. And the state of Israel itself, when it's founded in 48, it was due to a coincidence in a way of events in which both the US and Russia happened to support it at the same time for their own geopolitical reasons. But neither had anything to do with the Holocaust. The Zionists who campaigned for the foundation of the State of Israel, yes, certainly their movement was inspired by a desire to create a safe place for Jews to live where they were not going to be persecuted. But it wasn't specifically the Holocaust, it was a whole history of anti-Semitism. And another way of demonstrating that the State of Israel was not founded because of the Holocaust is that the Zionists were not much interested in the Holocaust when it was happening. They really, I mean, it's arguable whether they could have done much to save the Jews who were being murdered in Eastern Europe, but they could have made a big noise about it. And you notice from certain groups who did make a big noise and got things done that they could have saved a lot of lives if they'd made a lot of noise, but they weren't interested because their concern was always to save the Jews as a people, the Jewish people, not to save individual Jewish people. And you actually have quotations from some of the leading Zionist figures, saying the Jews who die in the Holocaust are sacrificing themselves for a greater cause. Now, these Jews never decided they wanted to sacrifice themselves. They never offered the option. But that's the way the Zionists saw it. So the idea of the Holocaust being a justification for anything that Israel does is nonsense.
Yeah, it's a funny one that I made a note in my mind as I was editing that clip to make that very point myself. And with time constraints, I didn't make that point. I should have made it during the monologue, of course. The idea of creating the State of Israel obviously predated the Holocaust. Of course it did. Andrew Barr is our guest. Andrew is an author and historian. It's coming up for 17 minutes past the hour of 5 o'clock. Very contentious. And you've taken some stick for it. Because you've been saying since October 7th that you believe the Israeli government was complicit in allowing it to happen, and you just touched on it there, that Zionists have a history of sacrificing their individual Jews in the interests of the bigger picture. How far did it go, do you think, on October 7th? Was there foreknowledge of something being cooked up by Hamas, and was that then ignored? Was it even more sinister than that? I mean, I've read some fascinating pieces in the Times of Israel, even going back to October 8th, October 9th. How bad was it in terms of the Israeli government's complicity in that?
Well, we may never know exactly. I mean, I called it on the day itself because it seemed that we were being played in some way. Partly, I think, because of my experience of the Israeli government's response to COVID, in which it had forced its population through the use of the green card and through excluding unvaccinated people from society to force his population to act as guinea pigs for the vaccine, which clearly has led to the deaths of many, many thousands of Israelis. So if it was prepared to sacrifice
can I jump? Sorry, Andrew. Yeah, and if I didn't jump in there,
go
I'd
on.
Be shot by my old journalism lecturers.
Go on.
Where's the proof that the jabs have killed thousands of Israelis?
I don't think there is a figure. I mean, you've probably seen all the estimates for the deaths from the jabs globally. And the biggest estimate was Denis Roncourt, who I think has quoted a figure of 17 million, which seems extraordinary to me.
Yeah.
But I mean, all we can go on, because the data on which calculations could be made have deliberately been hidden, those calculations cannot be made. So people are left making estimates based upon, in many cases, anecdotal evidence. Now, so I don't know for sure how many Israelis died as a result of the jab. I can't be certain about it.
But you think, you know, thousands is maybe not unlikely. Yeah, I'm not being...
It's not a wild estimate, put it like that. But I don't know for sure. You're absolutely right, because they've gone out of their way to make sure we can't know for sure.
And I interrupted your flow. I had to do that because it's thousands. And if I didn't, the people who disagree with you would think I'm a bit of a bastard. But anyway, your point was, here's this government, you know, of the Israelis, of the Jewish people in Israel, and it's engaging in a terrible program of oppression against the Israelis of Israel. I remember talking about it, the green card. You know, you can't go to the gym, you can't go to the restaurant. You've got to have the jabs. And this particularly horrified you, didn't it?
Well, yes, given that they keep on talking about how the state of Israel was founded because of the Holocaust, which, as we just discussed, is not correct, but that is the narrative that they propose. So I think a lot of people said to me that what on earth is happening in Israel? As a Jew, I'm not responsible for anything that happens in Israel, and it's an interesting phenomenon, shall we say.
Amen.
That diaspora Jews, British Jews, American Jews always tend to take the flak for anything that's happened in Israel, and that's true going back decades. Goes back to when the Zionists were fighting the British to create their own country in the late 40s, and they were carrying out terrorist acts. And there's a particularly notorious case of two British sergeants, who were hanged by the Zionists as a reprisal for the hanging of three Zionist militia. And this led to massive anti-Jewish riots here in Britain. So this is always an issue. But going back to the point, Jews tend to get always asked, well, what's happening in Israel? You're Jewish, you'll be able to explain. There's no specific reason why I should know better than anyone else what's happening in Israel. I'm a Jew living in here in Britain.
Yeah, but that's not giving you flack, though. Yes. That's not somebody giving you flack. Because I want to take issue with this idea that Jews get flack. Because I do ask Jews. And I know, I don't know what you think of this program. I know you listen every now and then. But I'm about the fairest guy that I know. I'm going to give myself a pat on the back. I am as fair as you can be.
Go ahead.
And I speak to Jewish people all the time. I really do. And I ask them, friends of mine, and I say, look, do you get shit, really, excuse the crude language, do you get it in the neck when Israel goes into Gaza, you know, 2014, 2015, 2 years ago now? And overwhelmingly, the answer is no. No, Richie, we don't get it. Now, somebody's saying to you, Andrew, you are Jewish. What's going on there? That's fairly harmless, right?
Yes. No, it's the expectation that I have some special knowledge or insight, which I felt you kind of feel obliged that you have to, because everyone expects it of you. It's that way round. But definitely, going back to the original question about October the 7th, I was initially suspicious because of what had happened in Israel with the vaccine rollout. And then I've seen lots and lots of bits of evidence about intelligence operatives who reported what they'd seen to their senior officers and were knocked back, told not to talk about it. I imagine you've talked about this kind of thing on your show when I haven't happened to be listening. There's the obvious issue of why it took the defense forces 7 hours to respond to the initial attack on October the 7th, which nobody's answered. I mean, the answer is always, the official answer is always, we'll look into that after the war is over, which seems to me unnecessary stalling. I mean, why couldn't they look into that now? The same people who were in charge on October the 7th, whatever happened, even if it was an intelligence failure, they're still in charge now, which surely gives nobody any confidence.
Yeah, it's a very good point.
Whether they were just incompetent or whether they corrupt.
Very good point, yeah. And I noticed there were a number of Israeli men and women, not necessarily journalists, but they were screaming bloody murder on Twitter on October 8th, October 9th, October 10th. And you think it's possible that they allowed it to happen. And then, if that is the case, the obvious next question, the follow-up question would be, why? And I think you think it's because they planned or wanted to do what it is they've done since October 7th. Is that fair?
I would think so. I mean, we're in the realm of hypothecation here. The thing I came across recently, which you alluded to a little while ago, was this idea of there being a history of Zionists sacrificing Jews for the cause of the Jewish state. And it's what we mentioned about World War II, that Zionists were not really interested in saving Jews from the Holocaust. They actually went out of their way to obstruct other Jews who were trying to save Eastern European Jews from the Holocaust. A number of well-documented instances of this, because they didn't want Jews escaping from Eastern Europe to America or Canada or Argentina. They only wanted Jews to come to Palestine and nowhere else, and Jews weren't being allowed into Palestine by the British. So it was a kind of stalemate there. And you also get the problem that the Zionists tried to stop, a lot of Zionists, it's not all Zionists, there were a few very, very enthusiastic Zionist campaigners who tried to get the news of the Holocaust to come out, but there are also a number of them, particularly leadership, who actively tried to stop the news of the Holocaust from coming out, lest there be a public outcry for more to be done for the Jews of Eastern Europe and for them to be brought over to Britain or America or Canada or wherever.
Tell me what you understand about the Havre Agreement. Do you remember this caused a huge problem for former London Mayor Ken Livingstone? Livingstone spoke about it, and before he knew where he was, the anti-Semitism witchfinder general, John Mann from Labour, was chasing Ken Livingstone all over London, accusing him of anti-Semitism. Because I've studied history like you have, not like you, you're far more advanced than me, Andrew, and I've travelled to these horrible places. I was in Dachau and I was in Auschwitz, and I've spoken to so many people on radio over the years, survivors, not many around these days, sadly, but I interviewed survivors, and it's such a massive thing, right? But in the early 30s, there was a plan. Hitler's government had a plan to repatriate German Jews. What went wrong there? Do we understand?
Right. If we can accept that the final solution wasn't decided upon until the early 1940s, and that's constantly argued over, then Hitler's policy in the 1930s was to try and get the Jews out of Germany.
Yeah.
Ken Livingstone's mistake was to say that Hitler supported Zionism.
Right, it's a bit
Hitler
stupid.
Hitler didn't support Zionism. He didn't want a Jewish state in Palestine. He definitely didn't want that. But it looks like the main interest of the Nazi government in the 1930s was to get the Jews out of Germany. Then their plans changed and they decided that they wanted to get rid of the Jews from anywhere. And the plans changed, it's argued, in 41, 42. The transfer agreement in 33 was simply a means of trying to get some Jews out of Germany, and it was a deal that they could get some of their money out.
Yes, and their possessions
as well. The reason why it was so controversial was that there was a Jewish boycott of Germany, an economic boycott, trying to cripple the Nazi government. And obviously the transfer agreement broke this boycott. But it's a matter of great dispute as to A, how much impact a Jewish boycott of Nazi Germany could have had anyway, and what difference this transfer agreement, which wasn't a huge number of Jews, would have made to the impact of this boycott. And there were other areas in which the boycott was broken in any case. So that's the argument over it. I mean, the Ken Livingstone thing, I would totally agree with anyone who says, well, it's just the weaponization of anti-Semitism to bring down prominent figures on the Labour left associated with Jeremy Corbyn.
I think you've been very brave, really, in calling that out, because it's not something that makes you popular. You know, it's the reason I think we spoke first time around, the use of anti-Semitism to bring down people who, you know, yeah, to all intents and purposes, we look at them and we know they don't hate Jews or they don't have any special antipathy towards Jewish people. You've taken some flack for that, Andrew, haven't you, over the years, because you've isolated yourself a little bit, I think, haven't you?
I have this small group, Jews for Justice, which I think we all agree about the weaponization of anti-Semitism. We don't all agree about what's going on in the Holy Land at the moment. We've had a lot of arguments, as is true about Jews in the freedom movement generally. It's kind of split the freedom movement in a way that is very dramatic. And I often wonder, was it deliberate or just an accidental byproduct? I don't know. But yeah, what I've said about October the 7th has led fellow Jews to accuse me of blood libel, which is about as severe as you can get an accusation against any Jew. And of course, is complete nonsense, because blood libel was this story spread about in the Middle Ages about Jews using Christian blood to mix in the matzahs for their Passover and their seders. So it's completely different. But that's the kind of accusation that's been... I think the problem is that when Israel is attacked, and certainly Israel was attacked on October the 7th, there tends to be a circling of the wagons. So all these people who really hated Netanyahu and have been campaigning for however long to bring him down have now got in behind the government for the duration of the war.
Yes, and he had a lot of problems pre-October 7th. It was very unpopular. His policy to limit the power of the Israeli courts was obviously a very unpopular policy, and it looked like he was dead in the water. I'm not suggesting for a moment that Netanyahu himself had anything to do with October 7th, but he certainly benefited as much as anybody has from it. You're listening to Andrew Barr. Andrew is a historian and author, and he happens to be Jewish. Let me ask you this. This is controversial, but look, first of all, before I ask you this, isn't it so regretful? There you are, and you say, look, to your Jewish colleagues in Jews for Justice, you say, look, I wonder, did they allow this to happen, to give them the pretext to go into Gaza? And this is not unique to Jewish people now. This is unique to human beings. What has happened to us that, what has happened to our discourse, Andrew, where people begin to take things so bloody personally? And they can't separate the personal from the opinion. And why can't those friends of yours just say, well, Jesus, Andrew, I'm not sure about that. That sounds a bit conspiracy theory to me. Why have we become so contentious with one another? Why have we become so polarized in general, do you think, about everything?
And why does this particularly apply to this issue, which seems to be the most polarizing issue out there?
Yeah.
The freedom movement, everyone was claiming, oh, we don't have left or right anymore. We have libertarian and authoritarian. And as soon as Everson blew up in October, suddenly the freedom movement split along left-right lines. So the left is all pro-Palestine and the right is all pro-Israel. And the significant, for example, the Daily Skeptic and the Conservative Women are both very, very strongly pro-Israel. Whereas you will know a lot of the more left-wing members of the freedom movement who have taken a very strong pro-Palestinian stand.
Yeah.
And I do wonder whether this was predicted by someone. I mean, I hadn't predicted it, but everyone just so fell into line. And now it's very, very hard to plough any kind of middle furrow. So you see, poor Jonathan Glazer, the director of that wonderful Holocaust film, The Zone of Interest, that came out recently, he has had terrible flack for saying what he thought was something relatively moderate at the Oscars about dehumanization and how it related to his film. Because you're not allowed to say anything moderate anymore. You've got to be Team Israel or Team Palestine. It's divide and rule.
It's the same on every subject, really. It is the same on every subject you care to talk about. It's been a source of great frustration to me over the years. It's meant that we don't get to have debates like we used to have. Whereas, you know, these days people, because they've become so polarised. You know what, Andrew? I made the mistake and I used to think people were cowards. Now, I don't mean people who chose not to come on here because of any allegations of anti-Semitism about me. I don't mean those people. But say people in the Green Movement, you know, because I don't buy anthropogenic climate change stuff. And I used to think they wouldn't come on because they're cowards. So that was me being egotistical. But in reality, it's got nothing to do with cowardice. It's because of the programming. They are so sanctimonious, and maybe I'm guilty of it myself sometimes, so absolutely sure they are right that the person espousing the opposite point of view becomes an enemy. And that's terrible. It destroys discourse. It destroys great radio shows and TV shows like we used to have for years when everybody would come on. I mean, you'll remember Oprah interviewing the Ku Klux Klan. I mean, come on. It was gripping television, right? Here you have this black woman, this businesswoman, and she's interviewing guys, you know, who, given the opportunity, they'd throw a rope over a tree and they would hang her. I mean, it was brilliant stuff, but you just can't have these conversations anymore. On this, I want to ask you this as a historian. Are there some aspects of history that are completely off limits when it comes to revisionism? So this is a loaded question, obviously. Look, I've interviewed
people. And we know what you're aiming at.
Yes, because I've spoken to people over the years. They certainly are not anti-Semitic. They certainly do not hate Jewish people. And they certainly believe that the Nazis attempted to exterminate every Jew in Europe. So they believe this and they know this has happened. But they have different opinions about how the Nazis went about it. And some of them have been terribly demonised and banned, and some people went to jail for it. I interviewed a guy years ago who said, I don't think they'd have been able to cremate so many bodies, Richie. I think they shot most of them. It's horrible to be speaking about victims of genocide like that. You know, I don't mean to be, again, I don't mean to be crude. But I feel sorry for some of those guys. They're not all Jew-hating people. They're genuinely wondering, why can't we have a look back again at how this was done and have a discussion about it? Or is it off limits? Should it be off limits? Should we just say, look, they gassed the Jews, they attempted to burn, or they cremated so many of them, and just be done with it? Or can we go back and have a look? What say you?
Well, I mean, the comment you made about shooting and gassing, horrendous though it is, I mean, touches on serious Holocaust scholarship, which has, as far as I'm aware, changed in recent years, in which it used to be imagined that a lot more people, not more Jews and indeed others, were gassed. And now it's believed that relatively a much higher proportion were shot over trenches or whatever. There's also this whole argument about whether the Holocaust only involves Jews or involves all those other groups. And I don't mean relatively small groups like the Gypsies and the homosexuals. I mean the big groups like the Slavs, the millions of Slavs that the Nazis murdered for ideological reasons rather than as part of the war. Are they Holocaust victims too? And this becomes a huge political argument about ownership of the Holocaust. Is the Holocaust about Jews or is it about everyone who was murdered by the Nazis?
And what do you think? What's your opinion on that?
Well, I think what we tend to do in the group is we tend to distinguish the word, the Hebrew word Shoah, the disaster, which applies to the Jews who were murdered, and then Holocaust can be used for everyone who was murdered by the Nazis. That would seem to me a fair distinction, not least because, going back to the point I made earlier about the Israel and the Eichmann trial in the 1960s, that's when the word Holocaust came into the English language, was for everyone who was reporting on the Eichmann trial in Israel for English language newspapers. They needed a word to translate the Hebrew word Shoah, and so they used the word Holocaust. Right. So that's really where it came into popular usage.
It's really interesting this to be having this conversation. It's 22 minutes to the top of the hour. It's Wednesday's Richie Allen Show. Andrew Barr, historian and author, on the programme with us today. I'm going to just push you a little bit. I think I ought to push you. Look, I think what's happening, and if I've got some bias towards Israel, look, maybe I have, I don't know. I think what's happening is genocide. I really do. I know there are people saying it for their own political reasons. I know there are people saying it for ideological reasons. But for me, I think enough evidence is in now to suggest they followed those people as they moved them from town to town. They did bomb them, and then they tried to render the places they had left uninhabitable. It's just, and you hear Medecins Sans Frontieres coming out today saying they attacked a hospital, there were no terrorists here. I just think it's genocide. Are you being diplomatic? And by the way, that's not. I'm not saying that being diplomatic is a bad thing. It can be a good thing. Or are there consequences for somebody like yourself for saying it is genocide, Richie?
Well, I think there'd be more consequences in many ways for me not saying it's or not as I'm
fair enough
currently doing, not committing myself. Because all my friends in the freedom movement have all, and in my groups, and I don't just have a Jews for Justice group, I have a local campaign group. They've all been going on about genocide for ages, trying to say to me, no, look, Andrew, surely you agree it's genocide. And I've been very careful to say I'm not committing myself. What I would say is we don't know what the Israeli plan is. They've been quite coy about it. Is it ethnic cleansing of the whole? Was it always intended that they were going to ethnically cleanse the whole of Gaza? Was that the purpose? What is the function of the hostages, which tends to be, I mean, it's talked about a lot by Jews and Israelis, bring them home and all that. The question is, were the hostages allowed to be captured in the first case? And are the hostages being used by both sides as hostages? Because it's in the Israeli government's interest that they can keep on saying we're trying to rescue the hostages, but we have to carry out a military operation first, and they just keep on going. And that has the benefit for them of keeping the Israeli population on side, because they keep on saying, yes, we've got to bring home the hostages. The thing is, the redemption of hostages, if you're at all a religious, an observant Jew, is one of the most important mitzvot, one of the most important commandments there is. So that should have been their prime concern. And it has been historically. There was a famous hostage exchange in 2011 when one IDF soldier was redeemed for 1,026 prisoners from Israeli jails, which I suspect was a mixture of terrorists and people they were just holding suspected of terrorism. And the guy who was the mastermind of the October 7th attack, the leader of Hamas in Gaza, Sinwar, he was one of those released then. So that's the disadvantage of this principle of redeeming hostages. So it's never a simple black and white solution, but clearly the hostages are being used as a weapon as well.
No doubt about it. There was something came into my mind now on that. It's just I've gone right out of my mind. Andrew Barr is our guest. It might come back to me. Just to move away from Israel at the moment.
Yeah.
I've had a brilliant question from a listener. You being a historian on another matter entirely, we might find we might have a good argument here, you and me. You might see this different to me. But our listener Isabel asks, Richie, it would be fascinating to hear what Andrew thinks about giving financial reparations to the descendants of slaves. Now, this is contentious, Andrew. Is this contentious or what? I myself think it's preposterous. I mean, if somebody said to me, Richie, we're going to give you £1,000 to go and shop till you drop because of the British Empire's part in the famine in Ireland, I'm not going to refuse it, Andrew. But I don't believe I should get it. And I certainly do not believe that anybody living in Britain in 2024 owes me any apology. What are your thoughts on it?
Well, maybe the one, I mean, in the first case, as a descendant of slaves myself,
yes,
a mere 3,300 years ago. Obviously, I'm expecting reparations from the Egyptian government. That's right. I mean, at what point do you draw that line?
Yeah.
And more immediately, the reparation question is quite relevant here, because one topic that's really not much discussed is the experience of the Mizrahi Jews, the Eastern Jews, the Jews who used to live in Arab countries until they were all expelled in the late 1940s, 1950s. And there's a whole push-pull argument as to how far they were expelled, how far they left for Israel, because there was now a place they could go to. I think, as with the Nakba, there are lots of different explanations for different people. Ryan Christian mentioned Avi Shlaim, who had a particular theory about Iraq, which is quite contentious, which again, I would be very happy to discuss with him in detail at another time. But there is a whole issue of reparations there, because if you have Palestinian Arabs making claims on the land they used to own in Israel, or the land they used to work in Israel, because in most cases it was an absentee owner somewhere in Damascus, wasn't it? There's also all these Mizrahi Jews who were kicked out of Arab countries, most of whom were taken in by Israel, who hold the titles to vast tracts of land in all the countries from which they were expelled, amounting to, I think it's five times the land area of the state of Israel.
Is that right? I didn't know that.
So that's an interesting question.
Yeah, it is a very interesting question.
And
yeah.
That was not, you know, that's not that, if we're saying that's not that long ago in terms of Nakba, this is exactly the same date as the Nakba. So at what point do you draw the line for reparation? I honestly don't know, Richie.
Do you think that guys like me, that we are harder on the state of Israel for committing crimes that are committed elsewhere around the world by our own governments, and in fact are being committed right now, today, as we speak? I can talk about Yemen, I could talk about other parts of the world. Has there always been a holding Israel to a higher standard? And if so, why might that be the case? Why do we despise even more what Israel does to the Palestinians than we despise what our governments have done in Libya, in Iraq, in Afghanistan and Syria?
That's another extremely hot potato, and there are lots of different answers to that one. Israel, I think, should hold itself to a higher standard. Israel was intended, when it was founded, to be a new kind of country that wasn't oppressive in the way that previous states had been, that had equal rights for all its citizens, that had a much better attitude towards the third world, and in many ways, and was originally socialist in its inspiration, although that had disappeared by the 1970s. So that's part of the answer. I can certainly understand why Israelis in particular and Zionist Jews would see the singling out of Israel as being anti-Semitic. I don't think it's done for anti-Semitic reasons, but I can certainly see why they would think it, because people are so much harder on Israel than they are on other countries. It's partly because it's always in the news. It's partly the fashion of the time, just as the Vietnam War was a thing that everyone cared about at one time. Nuclear disarmament was a thing everyone cared about at one time. And it's been on the left, the cause has been the Palestinian cause.
Do you know, yeah, this is interesting. I would have said until very recently that one of the reasons is that we can clearly see that Israel has a very heavy and a very successful influence in public life here in the UK and in the United States. And maybe that irks Israel's opponents in this country. But no, it's probably a little bit more complicated than that, because again, we could go back to what we're doing. You know, jump in there.
Sorry, there's also the whole issue, which is not my area of expertise, about this narrative about settler colonialism and the colonial oppression and white guilt, which is built into the whole Israeli-Palestinian issue, which we don't, I mean, I could happily go into another time, but I don't think we'd have the time to more than touch on it now.
probably not now, no, but I'd love to get into it. I did interview several times over the years the Israeli historian Shlomo Zand. And if you want to go and find those, believe me, I did my job. I was more than aggressive getting stuck in with him, putting alternate points of view to him. But Shlomo's theory is he doesn't believe there's any archaeological or historical evidence of the diaspora. That's very contentious. I'm guessing you probably disagree with him.
Yeah, there's Shlomo Zand. I would love to have a conversation with him. I've recently disproved one of his key arguments entirely by chance. I was reading a book about the history of a book called Roman Jerusalem, about the history of Jews in the Roman Empire. And I discovered that there was a state called Israel, in fact, two states called Israel, during the Roman era, both set up by rebel groups of Jews in the late 60s AD and the early 130s AD, and they called their state Israel. And the evidence for that, there's no written evidence, but there's coinage evidence. And it's this coins. Is relatively new coinage evidence, but this is evidence that Shlomo Zand should have been aware of. And he states categorically there was no state called Israel before the foundation of the modern state of Israel in 1948.
Yes.
Now, he might well be right about the Kingdom of David and Solomon, that it was never quite the state it was claimed to be. But the fact is, there was a state called Israel in the first and second century AD.
And the coinage is there. Hey, speaking of coinage, just before we part company today, with your background in history and writing, where do you think, I mean, you must have the coordinates for that buried treasure just off the coast of Cornwall, do you? They reckon there's billions down there, Andrew. I'll split
so
it with
I'm
you.
I'm completely unaware of that. Right? So
it's a mad story, yeah. There is a ship, isn't there? I mean, it's been in the news lately. A galleon, a big mad ship went down, and they reckon there are billions of pounds. It's a gold rush underway at the moment, people trying to figure out where it is. I thought you might have the inside skinny on where to go. Look, it was brilliant having you back on. Jews for Justice. I'll put links to where people can find you and, of course, the Substack on the podcast notes. Really appreciate your time, Andrew. I can't say that enough. I really do, mate. It's nice to have you on. And I hope you'll come back. So if there's a final word you wanted to have, now's the time to have it.
No, thank you very much, Richie. I feel that we kind of touched on things. And once again, I'm thinking about all the last time when I went on, we never discussed the thing that we've been intending to discuss in the first case. At least we did that this time. But there's so many more issues we could cover. It's such a big topic and it touches everything.
It certainly does. Next time you come on, I'll give Ryan plenty of notice. We'll get Ryan on. And I'm pretty sure that in the near future, Shlomo Zand would not be, reluctant to come on and have a proper intellectual 90 minutes about what's going on. And more importantly, what did go on hundreds of years ago, if not thousands of years ago. So, it's been a pleasure, Andrew. Thanks so much. And speak again soon.
Thanks, Richard.
Bye for now. Andrew Barr, who set up Jews for Justice. Andrew is a historian and author. And as I said, links to where you can find Andrew on social media, but also his Substack, will be on the podcast notes for this show. The podcast will be online in about 40 minutes' time. The live show hasn't much to go. I'm going to read some of your comments right now. Let me read them. Hello to Paul. Richie, as far as the Nazis, Hitler, etc., was enabled by the deep state, financed maybe by Rothschild and others, there are no oil fields in Germany. So an embargo on oil imports into Germany in the Second World War could have stopped Hitler in his tracks. This did not happen. This is an excellent point Paul is making. And Paul, I wish I had read that. I would have mentioned this to Andrew. Yes, they could have sanctioned the German government, as it was. Somebody has given me some stick, and Andrew, for constantly referencing Nazis and not Germans. It might be Roger. Is it Roger? No, it's not Roger. Is it Mick? Is it Mick? No, it's not Mick at all. I don't know who it is. But that's a very good point. Yes, they could have. That's right. It's Brian. Brian says, Richie, I wish you and Andrew would stop parroting the term Nazis. It was the Germans. Take a look at many of the old newsreels of the time. You are letting the German nation off the hook. Well, that wasn't the intention, Brian. It's a catch-all term, isn't it? J. Jacqueline says perhaps we hold Israel to higher standards because they are justifying their actions in the name of religion. And religion should be about love, acceptance and tolerance. So their hypocrisy is more obvious and disgusting than the other evil countries like the UK and the US. Jacqueline, thank you for that. Cookie says, wouldn't they have just done what Eisenhower's death camps, save on the bullets, says Cookie. Thank you. Pietro says, we should always remember to ask ourselves qui bono. Often the state of Israel features in most geopolitical events, says Pietro. The state of Israel exerts far too much influence through AIPAC in the US and through its influence in European countries and in EU. Israel influences EU foreign policy, says Pietro. I had a big row with, I don't know if it was Kevin Barrett. It might have been Paul Craig Roberts, actually. Now, I love Paul, and Paul will be back on the show in the near future. But 5 or 6 chats ago, if that makes any sense, 5 or 6 chats ago, maybe 18 months or so ago, Paul and myself got into a proper ding-dong about Israel. And I came to the conclusion a few years ago, Israel is, in my opinion, it's an apartheid state. I agree with Andrew. It serves no purpose to argue about whether it should exist or not. He's absolutely right, because it does exist. Like it or lump it, it's there. And the Israelis and the Jews there are not going anywhere. Whatever we might think about what the Israeli government does and how it is supported by the US and the UK, amongst others. But my point at the time was very contentious. I said I don't blame Israel any longer, as much as I blame those who enable Israel. You know, I blame the European Union, the UK in particular, and the United States in particular, for Israel getting away with that which it gets away with. Israel has had, and this is my opinion, it has largely had, well, certainly in recent years, psychotic administrations. Now, that's a very general thing to say, but that's my opinion. If you continue to send money and weapons to a psychopath, you know, don't you at some stage become as bad or worse than the psychopath in question? It's the point I made with Paul, and we got into a bit of a Barney about it. You know, and who influences who? Is it the US influencing Tel Aviv? Which country is the puppet? Is Israel the puppet or is the United States? But, yeah, interesting stuff. Gaz says, Richie, 'twas a shame that James O'Brien wasn't aboard the boat in Baltimore with a wee anchor, because what better replacement to have at hand for an anchor than the world's biggest... I'm not going to say it. I'm not going to say it. Very good, though, Gaz. Very good. Tomorrow, Tony Gosling is among the guests, the radio presenter and friend of ours from Bristol, former BBC journalist. I'm sure he'll have something to say about what's been happening in Gaza and the announcement or the finding of Francesca Albanese. But we're going to talk about much more besides. I think Tony wants to get into the recent drama around the royal family, amongst other issues. So Tony will be on the programme tomorrow. We will speak again tomorrow morning. The Papers podcast will be online round about 7 o'clock in the morning. And then I'll be on air at 4 o'clock tomorrow, the usual time, 4 o'clock. So all that's left for me to say is thank you to my guests, thank you to Andrew Barr, and also thank you to Ryan Christian, the last American vagabond. Until tomorrow, it's bye from me. Bye now.